We don't want the NSA to have to work too hard.
Okay. So welcome, everyone, to the December 30th, 2020, 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference. And now, Craig, will you take the role, please?
Sure. Who I have at the moment, I have Allison Menard, Ann Hendricks, Sheila Casey, Bill Wilk, Bonnie Faulkner. There's one here I'm having trouble with because I've got the wrong glasses on, but Pat McGuire, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Dan Hennen. I have John, is it John O'Keefe? Anyway.
The Boston person? Is that what you're talking about?
Is that the one? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You identified yourself. Could you give us your name again? I'm sorry. I think it was Kip or something like that.
Kip Beckford.
Perfect.
Kip or Skip?
Okay. Skip. Kip. I've got the spelling and everything, Carol, so we're good there. Apologies for that. So David Rolls, Fern Tishman, Greg Boyd, John O'Malley, John Olson, Lynn Cornelison, Al Megaletta, Marv Stannis. Let's see here. We have Marty McGee and Judy Osterman. There's a bit more. Hold on. Paul Zaremka, Peter Ketchum, and Richard Krushnick. Now, who did I miss? I must have missed someone. No? Okay. I guess we're good then.
Okay. So we're all set then? Okay. Yeah. Great. So we don't have any minutes to approve, so we need to just approve the agenda. Are there any objections to the agenda as written and sent out? Well, hearing none, then it's approved, and we can begin. Okay, so our first speaker tonight is Sunny Allison Menard, or just Sunny. Okay, and she's going to be introduced by Bonnie. So, Bonnie, if you're ready, go ahead.
Oh, okay, thank you. Our first speaker, Allison Sunny Menard, was scheduled to speak at the Question Everything Conference 2020 to be held in Austin, Texas in early November. I was scheduled to attend, as was Kat McGuire, and when it got postponed, we went to Austin anyway. We met with a great group of Texas truthers in Austin and then spent a day with Sunny Menard in Fredericksburg learning about her many experiences with the Colorado judiciary. Allison Sunny Menard is a graduate of Cornell University and the University of Denver College of Law. She's been licensed as a lawyer in Colorado since 1987 and was the 2002 Green Party candidate for Colorado Attorney General. Often litigating against developers and governments, she took many cases pro bono to vindicate the public interest, uncovering criminal activity, including her opponent's collusion with judges. For exposing this misconduct, she was targeted with a string of unprecedented, meritless actions against her license to practice law by minions of the Colorado Supreme Court without any client complaint and suspended three times. When illegally ordered to submit to a mental evaluation before she could be readmitted to practice, Sunny left Colorado. In recent years, she has, without compensation, assisted James Fetzer and Wolfgang Halbig in defending against lawsuits filed against them over their Sandy Hook research. As a result, she has spent the last year defending against more bogus charges that she's engaging in the unauthorized practice of law brought by Fetzer's litigation opponent, Jake Zimmerman. Due to the disciplinary siege, which has preoccupied her now for 14 years of her life, Sunny has researched the attorneys, judges, and regulatory authorities responsible for it. She will share her findings, in short, that there has been a concerted, organized takeover and subversion of the judicial system in Colorado and the U.S. generally. However, she will begin with a brief update on a complaint that she filed in the state of California against Bill and Melinda Gates for the unauthorized practice of medicine. So, okay. Okay, so here's Sunny.
Okay, so Sunny, you can hang on for one. Sunny, if you could hang on for one moment, okay. I'm going to put us in lecture mode. Just one second.
Okay.
Okay, and Sunny, you've just been unmuted. Yeah. Sunny,
yes,
so go ahead.
Yes, I have. Okay, thank you, Cheryl, and thanks, everyone. starting with Gates, and obviously, I thought about this unauthorized practice of medicine because I'm defending against charges of the unauthorized practice of law. And it really fits. The charge really fits. So I've filed six of these complaints, actually, in six different states. And they are states where the Gateses own property. And so far, I've not been successful. And I think, actually, I have a bite in one state, but I have to get a co-complainant from that state. That's my interpretation of what they're telling me. I mean, it's actually shocking because I wrote a really comprehensive complaint. They are, both of them are diagnosing for disease. They're prescribing drugs. You know, they're just issuing medical advice all over the place and recommendations. And people who engage in much less extensive activity are prosecuted for unauthorized practice of medicine. Like in California, one example is a guy named Josh Zahner, who is known as a celebrity biohacker because he's done things to himself, like administered CRISPR gene editing to himself. And, he's an internet sensation. And in fact, he's a scientist. And the articles, I don't know what the outcome was. And I tried to contact him and failed. But anyway, they went after that guy. So will they go after Gates? I'm told instead that they don't have jurisdiction. They absolutely do have jurisdiction because they are charged with protecting the public against exactly such conduct. But anyway, I wanted to start with that because although I think California is still possible because I filed a motion for reconsideration, Georgia may be even more possible, and I'm really hopeful there. But I wanted to let people on this call know that what we really need is someone who will say, I am injured by this activity by Gates in these particular states, and I'll state what they are. They are California. I'm forgetting about Florida and Washington. Both of those immediately rejected the complaint. Georgia, Illinois, New York, and Connecticut. So in those states, we're trying. And I say we because I have some correspondents who are supportive. But I'm the one who's been filing them. Anyway, so please contact me if you can come on these complaints with me as a co-complainant, especially if there's a Georgia resident. I think we have a good shot there. And, the penalties are severe. It can include, should include, I mean, it's criminal. It's criminal conduct. So it should include jail time. But also, what we have is a good case, although I didn't make this case expressly yet, but it's a case of bioweapons. When you read about what this vaccination, all of these vaccines for COVID have in them, I mean, this is not good stuff. They have tracking devices, nanoparticles, and a lot of adjuvants and thimerosal and aborted fetal tissue. Regardless of how you feel about that, that's actually dangerous. I mean, it's foreign DNA that's going in with the vaccine. So anyway, please let me know. My email address is dinophile@gmail.com. So it's like dinosaur, but it's dinophile, D-I-N-O-P-H-I-L-E. Okay, that said, I'll just start with what I've been going through for the past year, which is ridiculous. I've been accused of engaging in the unauthorized practice of law in Wisconsin, where I've never been licensed. And I am accused of violating the Wisconsin rules of professional conduct, even though I'm not an attorney in Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court says those rules apply to Wisconsin attorneys. Not only that, but their statute for the unauthorized practice of law requires compensation either for providing legal advice or drafting legal documents or appearing in a representative capacity. And I've done neither of those things. And so in this, so I'm being prosecuted by Colorado because they really need to get me. They're not done with me any more than I'm done with them. And I'm actually, you know, after going through this the original siege, which was between 2006 and 2010, and I moved out of the state, you know, I've done some writing, but only a fraction of what I need to write, because I really do have a lot to expose. And so I'm giving an overview, since that's all we have time for in this call, an overview of what I think has gone on. And it is a subversion and perversion of the judicial system in Colorado, as well as nationally, although my data is much more sketchy, obviously, when we come to the national picture. Although we will get to that, but I want to just state what the first step was in the takeover in Colorado. That occurred, as I see it, in 1966. Previously, judges had been elected there, and then a constitutional amendment was passed, which instituted a weird system. It's a crony system, whereby there is a committee that is appointed by the governor who makes recommendations for judges to the governor, and the governor then appoints them. And there's no vetting. There's no vetting even by the Colorado Bar Association. You know, and frequently when I was an attorney practicing there and I saw so-and-so has been appointed to a judgeship, I'd think, who is this person? I mean, if this person is a standout in the bar, why have I never heard of this person before? But that frequently happened. What I have to mostly, truncate is just the grounds for them going after me. I believe my bio said that I was a water lawyer, and my background was actually I have work experience as a geophysicist or in the geophysical industry and a degree in physics from Cornell. This intimidated my opponents in water law in Colorado. And, you know, what they say in the West is that whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. I mean, water is very contentious, and the development and the crazy development that we've seen in Colorado and maybe everywhere, obviously they need water. And so one of the hallmarks of the importance of water is that there is a special water court in each of the, there are seven water divisions. Each one is a major stream or river in Colorado. And then the appeal from the water judge is directly to the Colorado Supreme Court. So I had more Supreme Court cases than probably the average lawyer, because most of them don't do water law and they go to the Court of Appeals. So I had direct contact with Supreme Court justices. And again, you know, these justices, I forgot to mention one aspect of the changed system for putting judges in office, and that is that there is what's called a retention election, and it's after the first 2 years for district court judges and then every 4 years. For Supreme Court judges, it is after the first, after the first 2 years, and then there's 10 years before they have to stand for election again. And because the populace really, as a rule, doesn't have that much contact with judges, people don't know. And there also isn't publicity about bad judges. And the real problem is the regulatory system. And this is the system that went after me without a client complaint. And what these people did, it's called the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel. What they did was interfere with my ongoing cases to help my opponents. And this is absolutely what they did. They actually, although they posture and prance around as the moral bellwethers of the state, and, you know, they're supposed to be the absolutely ethical people because that's what they're doing is regulating attorneys. They're actually the worst. They're the worst. My contact with these people is that they are liars and they are unqualified. And so, I mean, I was going to go into my own situation, but I think what I'll do is go directly to what I learned about these people in the regulatory system as well as in the judgeships. One thing I learned pretty near the start of the research that I did was that several of my judges, including the presiding disciplinary judges in this series of bogus disciplinary cases they brought against me, they all got an award of, you know, like from the Catholic Lawyers Guild. And one of these awards is called the Thomas More Award. And I puzzled about that, and knowing, you know, what I had been through, I thought, you know, Thomas More was sanctified because he put the secular, he put the religious authority, the Pope, above the secular authority, the king, or in this case, the law. So that's what I believe. I mean, you never know what these people are getting their awards for, but they were all Catholic. And I'm sorry to if I offend Catholics, I'm sure I will, but they're the ones who really need to hear this, because I think they don't know. And because what I am seeing is primarily inculcated in the people who did these things to me is they obey. Instead of exercising their independent moral judgment, they are taught to obey. And they have certainly the comfort that is afforded them of this very encompassing religion from cradle to grave. And I really don't know anything about their religion other than what I have read since the siege against me. But suffice it to say that almost all of the people against, you know, who did this to me were Catholic. And then some of the key people have gotten this award. And I, there are little bits and pieces of, you know, other information that bears on this. For instance, one of the bad judges is a man named John Cain, who's a federal judge. And he actually had written something about the importance of the oath that judges take, which to me indicated that he had some concerns in that regard. Because, of course, every attorney and every judge, every official in probably every state, but in Colorado for sure, has to take an oath to uphold the Constitution and laws of the state of Colorado and the United States. And what I repeatedly ran into was they're thumbing their nose at the laws. And I thought, how can they live with themselves having taken an oath? Well, getting back to the Thomas More thing, what that exemplifies is that if they, I mean, that they have a duty to put their duty to the Pope or to the Lord, as they see it, above their duty to the Constitution and the laws. So that even though they have taken an oath, they are assured that they are serving a higher master. That is really what I think is going on. It's at the bottom of this stuff. So anyway, that was the beginning of my inquiry, and I then turned to John Scott Gleason, who was the head of the OARC, the Office of Attorney Regulation Council. And he was hired in he started work at that office in 1988. Well, I started looking for information about who is John Gleason, and in fact found very little. I only found two bios that were online where he spoke at conferences. And one of them said that he had been a prosecutor, or that he served in the prosecutor's office in Allen County. I'm looking at this thinking, there's no Allen County in Colorado. So I had to research it and found, put a lot together, because he didn't say where he'd gone to school either. He said that he earned a degree. I think this bio did say he earned a degree at Bowling Green State University. No, he didn't even say that. He said Columbia College. So he makes it sound like he went to Columbia University, but he didn't. He went, you know, I'll tell you about Columbia College, but what I found out is that he didn't graduate from Bowling Green State University, and he has made public statements that I found subsequently saying that he has an undergraduate degree from BGSU. He does not have that degree. So that's the first problem, is that we have this guy in office who has no undergraduate degree and has lied about it for 45 years. And I've proven that. And I proved it, for instance, I found out that Allen County is in Ohio. And he did live for a while in Ada, Ohio, and he's in the first 2 years of the yearbook of the Ohio Northern University Pettit College of Law. But there's no indication that he graduated from there either. And I actually made a field trip to Ohio and walked around in that school, and there are class pictures for every graduating class of lawyers in the law school, except for 1985, when he supposedly graduated. And the yearbook also changed its format. So there's actually no indication that he graduated from law school either, but the law school says on its website that it requires an undergraduate baccalaureate degree for admission. He did not have that. And not only that, it says that a third of the student body scored in the 25th percentile on the LSAT. Well, I have on my resume, and it's a true statement, that I scored in the 98th percentile on the LSAT. And the bar exam in Colorado is hard. I don't believe anyone who scored in the 25th percentile could pass the bar exam. And so that led me to look at bar exam passage. And I found something, but actually I want to put that off a little because there's a little more groundwork that I did. I mean, I found that he was actually hired to his first position at OARC. And mind you, this is the Colorado Supreme Court. It's like a section of the Colorado Supreme Court. He's an employee of the court. He was hired originally to an investigator position in 1987. And I found one ad for the position that was way before the internet, that was in the Colorado Lawyer, which was a magazine for lawyers. And it was published in the September 87 issue, and the closing date was August 25th, 1987. So it appears that they published an ad for a position that had already closed. And I tried to get Gleason's application. It's a public record, and a lot of stuff should have been filed with the application. Nothing was produced. I was told and in fact, it was a deputy attorney general who came in. It wasn't even Gleason himself, the head of the office at that time. I guess I didn't mention that he was the head of the office. He was in the office for, I'm forgetting now, it was 1988 to 2013. So that's 25 years or 26 years. And he was the head of that office. This guy without an undergraduate degree, who's lied about it for 45 years. Anyway, he was the head of that office for 15 years. So anyway, a deputy attorney general comes in and tells me that Gleason's application does not exist. Well, for a long time I thought he must have destroyed it. And then I realized, no, he never filed it. And actually, I remember applying to that job myself. I had just passed the bar exam. And, it did require 3 years of experience, but in fact, as I found out, Gleason didn't have 3 years. I didn't even get an interview. And I'm an Ivy League graduate, 98th percentile on the LSAT and stuff like that. I didn't even get an interview. And so, but also I believe that position closed before the application deadline. So I also found that John Gleason closed on a new house right at the time that position was advertised. He closed on a new house. I then looked at his mortgages. You know, I as part of my investigation, I went and unturned every stone I could think of. Part of it was to look in the property records. And what I found there was a string of second mortgages. And the first two mortgages, second mortgages that he got were from a man named Robert Bartholik, who is the only lawyer that employed Gleason before he went to OARC. And in fact, I talked to Mr. Bartholik, and he said that he did no litigation and he didn't really have that much for John Gleason to do. So Gleason, actually, I mentioned that online bio, the two online bios he found, where he said he had several years in private practice. Well, no, he didn't. He had at best 2 years with Robert Bartholik. Anyway, Bartholik gave Gleason his first two second mortgages, and they were for not huge amounts, like $10,000, or I should have gone through and checked these again, but they weren't huge. But then there did start to be big ones. And what I saw was releases filed very shortly after the mortgage was taken out. And, you know, banks don't let you do this. You can't refinance three times in 5 years, which is some of what's there. And, for instance, so he would take out a second mortgage, really substantial sums, and they would be paid off a short time later. And puzzling about this, I realized that's a bribery mechanism because there's no record of who paid off the mortgage. So I believe, in fact, I'm sure, and I state this unequivocally, that John Gleason was taking bribes to do what he did, which was the opposite of what someone in charge of that sensitive trust should be doing, which is that he prosecuted, you know, the people who were exposing corruption, like me, and I haven't, you know, even talked about that. Let's say the wildcat lawyers, the rogue independent lawyers like me, whereas he gave a pass to the corporate lawyers. Like, he never went after and there's really substantial attorney misconduct. I filed some complaints myself over, you know, before the stuff started coming down on me, and nothing ever happened to them. They never went anywhere. And other people I've come to know before and since have said the same thing. And those records, you know, of their disciplinary actions are confidential, except when they actually go after you, and then they publish it far and wide, and that's what's happened to me. I mean, I have really a terrible web presence, but Bonnie read my bio. I actually ran for Attorney General in Colorado in 2002. At that time, my web presence was stellar. All the good stuff is gone now. It's just horrible stuff. And so I just want you to know, if you start reading these disciplinary opinions, that I had complete defenses to all their charges, but they never mentioned my defenses. And so this is what they do. And it's organized and it's concerted. So I have a substantial case that John Gleason took bribes. And then, I mean, he did ultimately leave his position. And I don't know if my blog post, which, you know, I've got actually four blog posts about my findings on him, which have been, you know, the earliest one was 2010. So he did actually leave his job in 2013 and went to Oregon, where he held the same position for a year. And I found out that Oregon didn't even do a background check for this guy. Then he came back to Colorado, and now he's employed by a law firm that specializes in representing attorneys who have been charged with misconduct by Gleason's former office. So I see that as a payoff, too, that he landed in a soft spot with the firm that he had done favorable deals for. And, you know, so... He's got this wonderful job, and he doesn't even have an undergraduate degree, and I believe he has no valid law degree either, as I've intimated. Yet he's got the prestige and the salary and everything else that comes with being a partner at this firm. So then the part that I put off has to do with how he got into the bar. And this is really interesting because I got the list of who was on the board of law examiners in the year that Gleason was admitted to practice. And what's weird, actually, is that during some window of time that I haven't pinned out, but it was in the 1980s, Colorado had kind of an easy out on the bar exam. It was a 2-day bar exam, and the first day is what's called the multi-state, and it's a multiple choice exam, and the second day was essays. They had a thing where if you scored high enough on the multi-state, they didn't grade your essays, and that's actually how I got admitted, because I tend to do very well on these multiple choice exams, and so I put all my cherries in that basket, and which is good because my essays were not my, and we actually had a big blizzard when I took the bar exam too, so it was very difficult even to get there. But at any rate, I passed with a high score just on the multi-state alone. Well, what I realized, okay, then the next question or the next part of this is that There is a bar refresher course. Well, I mentioned that I was looking at the list of the people who were on the Board of Law Examiners, and I know many of them, and this is from the 1980s. I don't know who's on it now, but 1980s. I know many of them because, in fact, I was on the Colorado Bar Association's Ethics Committee myself until, you know, they started going after me. Actually, I stepped down myself because the leader of it stopped sending me packets, and she was sort of competitive with me in the water business, in the water law arena. But at any rate, I'm getting off track. So the Board of Law Examiners, I know many of them, and the names, they are almost all Catholic. I can't say, you know, from memory that they all are, or there were many that you just can't find that information out. But when you see names that are Irish or Hispanic, for instance, even Polish, it's a good bet. So anyway, there were ones that I know to be Catholic. And two immediately jumped out at me. And these were John Moy and James Lyons. And James Lyons is actually a good friend of Bill Clinton's. And I have a whole bunch of other stuff having to do with the Summitville mining disaster and those guys, both Clinton and Lyons. And Lyons also was the person who, he actually won or was awarded the Learned Hand Award, which I'd never heard of before, but that figured into something else I was doing at a different time in 1996. And Hillary Clinton appeared by video at this big reception, at which several of my judges attended to fête Jim Lyons. And Jim Lyons was actually the envoy that Bill Clinton sent, a special envoy to Northern Ireland, and he came up with the Good Friday Agreement. And, you know, my cynical view of this is he probably went over there with a suitcase full of cash, because those parties, you know, settled. And, you know, more than, you know, so that's maybe something that isn't as well supported as the rest of what I'm saying. but at any rate, so Jim Lyons and John Moy on the Board of Law Examiners, and they're both partners in high-powered firms. They're pulling down a lot of money, both of them. And here they are. Well, there's something else. They not only were on the Board of Law Examiners, but they founded a bar refresher course, which I even took. It was called Barbary. And they, you know, it's a little unclear to me whether they founded Barbary or they franchised their own bar refresher. But at any rate, they were running that course, even though they were partners in high-powered law firms. So I then, seeing that they were on the Board of Law Examiners, I contacted the woman who was the executive director. Her name was Susan Gleason, not related to John Gleason, and spells it differently. And I asked her, do the people on the Board of Law Examiners have access to the bar exams? Because, of course, this is the agency which gives the bar exam. And she said, yes. I said, did they have access to the questions before they're given? She said, yes. And I said, do they participate in grading them? And she said, yes. So then, you know, it's like I got a chill because I realized this is the mechanism or a mechanism for putting their chosen people into key slots in the Colorado judiciary and the bar itself. And what we saw in the case of John Gleason, and I'm sure there are others, and I have good candidates, but, you know, it's a problem. It's a problem even trying to figure out, did someone really pass the bar exam? Because they won't release the scores. And there used to be, like, big sheets of paper, the printouts, that they, you know, when they came out with the results of who passed, they would tape these big printouts to the glass windows of the Colorado Supreme Court. And you could go read and see if you passed the bar exam, you know, in May and then in, I guess, is it October? Yeah, for the February and July administrations of the bar exam. So anyway, they throw those away. But at any rate, so there's the mechanism. And so I believe that what's gone on or at least in the 1980s. What went on was what we've seen with the teachers' standardized test scandals, like in Atlanta and El Paso, where teachers actually, these have been RICO cases, where they found that teachers were actually erasing their students' wrong answers on, you know, the little fill-out bubbles, or they blacken in little circles on the score sheets. They were actually erasing wrong answers and putting in right ones. That happened in the standardized test arena, and that's what the Colorado bar exam consisted of. At least, you know, if you got a high enough score on this multi-state exam, that they never even graded your essays at that time. So that's how I feel sure John Gleason got into the bar, and, you know, without his, I believe, any type of degree. And I mentioned Columbia College because after he, I mean, when he came to college, he was in Ohio, and he, what he was after he, you know, he probably flunked out of Bowling Green State University. I found that he was enrolled for 1 year, and that, anyway, that he was enrolled for 1 year, which was his junior year, and I later found out that he had an associate of arts from a technical college. So then he went to Bowling Green State. He spent 1 year there, and then he was a campus cop. And I've got the yearbooks to show that, and I've got many other pieces of information. So he left. He got married there, and the two of them came to Colorado in 78, might have been 77, and he became employed by the Arapaho County Sheriff's Department. Cheryl, if I'm running over, just let me know, because I've gotten the main pieces out, but the rest is still interesting. anyway, so he came to the sheriff's office. Well, how about if I finish at 8? Although that won't mean questions were taken, but I can finish in 7 minutes, I think.
That's okay, and then we'll
is
still
that okay
do a
with
Q&A.
You?
Yeah, we'll do a Q&A after. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Anyway, yeah, this is sort of an aside, but not really, because I did a records request for his application file at the Arapahoe County Sheriff's Department, and that was where I got most of my information, because they did produce, you know, they weren't associated with the Supreme Court. And I just wanted to note some interesting things, like missing from his file again were all the things that you would expect for a sheriff's deputy. I mean, there's no background check. There are no fingerprint records. There's no credit history. There is really no application. It's just one page. And I also requested his immediate supervisor or superior, whose name was Pat Sullivan. Same deal. And yet, I forgot to even mention that I learned that John Gleason was in the military for 9 years. He was in the Ohio Air National Guard. And I believe he was not honorably discharged because they won't. There's something ambiguous on the one sheet they did provide me for records, which says court-martial : transcript not in file. That sure sounds like he was court-martialed. And certainly on none of his bios does he ever mention his military service. So I think he was not honorably discharged, and I can't get his DD-214 either, which is a public record. Well, same thing with his immediate superior, whose name is Pat Sullivan, and Pat Sullivan went on to be the sheriff of Arapahoe County for 20 years until there was a huge scandal because he was charged by certain people with offering inmates to bond out, offering people meth in return for gay sex, and they were people who were charged with crimes. And he offered that people could bond out in return for gay sex. And then his male lover was found floating in the South Platte River. Okay, so much of this was whooshed off the front page. But this guy even had the Justice Center named after him in Arapahoe County. But then they changed the name. But I looked in Pat Sullivan's file, and same deal. No, none of the documents that you would expect would be there. And then I asked for the file of Ed Nelson, who had been the sheriff when Gleason was hired, for all of 6 months after being elected, and then he died of a massive heart attack. And in Ed Nelson's file, all the stuff you would expect to be there is there, the background checks, the FBI, the fingerprints, the military record, the credit history, just really extensive application. All that stuff is there. But it wasn't for these other two. So this is really a heads up. And I'm wondering about these things on the way. And now it's going to seem like maybe a jump, but the final piece, well, it's not quite the final piece. I found that John Gleason also had his two closest friends or associates. One was this Robert Bartholik, and another one was a guy named John V. Egan III. They have both been the most worshipful Grand Master of Freemasons in Colorado at different times, and Bartholik's father also was. So I believe Gleason probably is a Freemason too, but I don't have that on him. I do definitely have it on his closest associates, and I mentioned Bartholik had given him these mortgages, which were then, actually those ones, I don't remember how soon after he took them they were paid back. But then my learning curve, I mean, all these guys are Catholic, and they are devout Catholics. But I think the key piece may be something called Opus Dei, which I learned about from the Da Vinci Code, which was a bestseller. And what this is a cult within the Catholic Church, which has basically taken over the Church. And it did that by getting the Vatican in its debt. It was raising money through all kinds of nefarious means, and including weapons sales. I mean, so this is not a peaceful group, and its membership is secret, but it is growing. It started in Spain in the 1930s, and very sick stuff. I've just finished a book by a man named Hutchison, Robert Hutchison, called, oh man, Their Kingdom Come, I think. Anyway, he's a journalist. It's all about Opus Dei, and what happened in the Da Vinci Code is true. They kill people, and they discredit them. In fact, their hallmark is dirty tricks, and that is actually what I experienced as a lawyer. And then, you know, so what their whole, so I believe they have taken over the judicial system. And I found, too, I mean, Gleason is one example, but there are many examples of people being imported into the state and becoming lawyers and rising to judgeships or other high-level positions who didn't have prior contacts with the state of Colorado. And granted, Colorado's, you know, a nice place to live, at least I thought so early on. I don't think so anymore. But so I found that the employees who, you know, several of the employees within the disciplinary system, like the guy who's prosecuting me now for unauthorized practice of law named Jacob Voss, he went to Notre Dame Law School. Also, the key guys that drove the disciplinary proceedings against me, one of whom was a Supreme Court justice, who I believe was also not qualified. I mean, he's a narcissist and a dirty trickster, and I could lay a lot about this guy, Greg Hobbs. He also went to Notre Dame to undergraduate. A man named David Robbins, who is his crony, who actually runs all the water business in the state. He has conflicts galore, but nobody ever gets him on his conflicts. This guy actually assaulted me in his office early on when I beat him on a motion and I suggested why he had not moved for summary judgment. And he went after me then and behind my back to my supervisor, to the attorney general, to my supervisors, to the legislators in the San Luis Valley, from the San Luis Valley, to the governor, to the head of the department. He went to all of them and told them I was causing problems in the case when I was successful in the case. It's just that he didn't want me ending his gravy train. And at the time, I thought that's what it was, that I was, by suggesting he move for summary judgment on a really sound basis. What I had seen was a discovery war that had lasted 3 years, and he continued the case for another 3 years. So I thought, I'm stopping his meter from running. But now I believe that's not what it was, because his reaction was so infuriated, and I sensed fear. And this is what I sensed when I saw John Cain's essay about the oath. He's afraid. He's afraid now that he's violated his oath, because he's a a piece of, you know, a so-and-so too, who just, they just thumb their noses at the law. They come up with like a set, it's almost a set recipe of excuses to avoid giving due process to people. And really what, you know, it's hard to make this whole case in a half an hour or 20 minutes, but what's really going on in the courts is asset stripping. It is that people or entities who have assets are targeted and hauled into court on bogus grounds and stripped of everything they own. And I have many, many examples of this. Maybe part two, I can go into those. But it's now 8:02, so I guess I'll stop now. And, yeah, I'm sorry to leave unanswered questions, but at least some questions will be answered. So, So.
Okay, thanks, Sonny. So now we're going to go into Q&A mode. Let me just do this. Okay, so you're unmuted, Sonny, so you're good. Anyone want to ask a question? It's star 6 to get in the queue. And while we're waiting for people to get in the queue, Sonny, I wanted to just ask you, what do you do with all this information that you have? Can you use this against these people, or is the system so corrupt that you can't? Or I don't know, maybe you've already
I tried. I have tried twice, actually, to bring a lawsuit, and the lawsuit is just deep-sixed. Like, for instance, when I filed one in Colorado to stop the siege against me, and I didn't really go over this other than to say what they were doing was causing the defeat of my clients, really severe harm to my clients, because when they start to go after an attorney, the attorney has to withdraw from active litigation. And so my clients were really harmed. So with one of those clients, I filed a suit in Colorado, and 8 federal judges and 5 magistrates voluntarily recused. And then we ended up before this man that I've just mentioned, John Kane, who just, what he did was he came on the case. I mean, we never got any of the rights that are guaranteed litigants under the federal rules of civil procedure. We never even had a case management conference. And twice we were set for a case management conference by the magistrate that was on the case, and then suddenly, 3 days before it happened, it was vacated and never reset. So I believe there was an instruction to the court. In fact, early on in that case, I had a judge named Phil Brimmer, and I did a preliminary injunction hearing before him, and got a lot of evidence out. And he denied the injunction, but I believe that he was honestly in error about something. And so I filed a motion to reconsider. And at the same time, the Colorado Attorney General's office, who was representing all the people I had sued, filed a motion to dismiss. And actually, Judge Brimmer struck their motion to dismiss, which is huge, because it almost never happens. But he did it because it didn't comply with his rules, and it just had to do with the page length, you know, number of pages. So I had asked him then, he struck their motion to dismiss. Well, the next thing that happens is Brimmer is off the case. He's suddenly recused without any reason stated of record. And, you know, I would really like to find out why, who said what to him. I mean, I haven't even talked about this, but one of the main things that my opponents, like David Robbins and Greg Hobbs, and a guy who is also a Notre Dame graduate who is Deputy Secretary of Interior named David J. Hayes, and maybe also Ken Salazar. Ken Salazar, in fact, was my opponent for Attorney General in 2002. But these guys, now I've lost my train of thought. I think that they actually caused maybe the Interior Secretary, that there was some very high-level federal official who told Brimmer that he could not sit on the case. And then we went through this crazy thing where all these judges recused. They were assigned the case, and they recused. And, you know, there's sort of a revolving, not a revolving, well, there's sort of a revolving door between the state judges and the federal judges, more one way, you know. But Denver is maybe unique in that so many courts are in one square mile. There's the Denver District Court. There's obviously the Denver County Courts. There's the Court of Appeals. There's the State Supreme Court. There's the U.S. District Court for the District of Colorado and the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And they're all friends. But it's more than just being friends. I actually think, so, okay, these guys I mentioned, I was litigating a water project. I was opposing it, and I had unbelievably good grounds, which should have meant that, you know, when the water judge dismissed everything, which he did in Durango, I should have gone to the United States Supreme Court. And I believe that these guys took me out of practice so I couldn't do that. And what I was doing was exposing, for instance, that they had violated a 1971 United States Supreme Court opinion by virtue of this project, which was called Animas La Plata. And I think, you know, I actually saw a reference by Robert David Steele to Jim Fetzer's case, because the judge acted the same way there. I mean, like he was afraid. That's my interpretation. Mm-hmm. Robert David mm-hmm. Steele said, not even seeing my interpretation, he said somebody dropped a national security letter on the judge. Well, I think that's what happened in the case I brought too. I mean, they were actually stunned by the level of corruption, and it's never yeah. been redressed or addressed. And ironically, I have seen that Phil Bremer is now the chief judge of the U.S. District Court in Colorado, which is a very good sign, because I thought he was honest. But he got off my case, and I don't know why. And then John Cain came on and just struck everything. He can't do that, but he did it. And he also threatened to sanctions against me multiple times in the first week he was on the case. I didn't deserve any sanctions. It's because I flagged a criminal enterprise. That's why. And that's what it is. Okay. And it is a total perversion. Anyway, thank you, Cheryl. I'm sorry, it was kind of a long
answer. Okay, no, that's okay. Thank you. Okay, now we have a question from John Olson. John, go ahead.
Okay, hi. John here in Maine. What state are you currently in?
Texas.
Texas, okay. And the last part of your email, was it at Gmail?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I've got something. I'll email you. What an impressive narration that was. At 90 miles an hour, you know, it's hard to keep up with you. And,
sorry.
I'm hoping you've written it down somewhere. If you ever want to move to Maine, I think we have a better climate here. we have a brand new Secretary of State who's a woman who has very high integrity, which I'll go into more later, maybe if on an email. We also, by the way, speaking of the vaccine stuff, we have a Greens Against COVID Repression group.
And oh, good.
I can tell you more about that. We have a very active email correspondence, and we'd love to have you join us on that. And
sure.
I'll just email you. Hopefully, I'll get that. I know Cheryl from the 9/11 work already, so I guess I'll let somebody else take it from there.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Okay. And next is Kat McGuire. Go ahead, Kat.
Hey, Sunny. Hi, it's Kat.
Hi, Kat. Hi.
thanks for the presentation. My question you might not be able to answer. It's sort of I'll just ask it. So you had really firsthand experience in Colorado, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering if as a result of that you have complete knowledge about what's going on there. If you have made ties or communicated with others around the country to see if similar kinds of these backroom bodies of Catholics or Freemasons or Opus Dei are, how widespread is this in other states? And in particular, do you have a feel for the degree that our Supreme Court is operating in such nefarious ways, for example, that they wouldn't take the Texas bill submission of a petition for the elections. And come to find out, it appears John Roberts was on the manifest for Jeffrey Epstein's island. So you know, how corrupt is he, and how are they going to do? So I'm just wondering, from other states all the way up to the Supreme Court, where it looks like, that was a strange decision to deny, well, to what degree do you see Colorado as just a case study for the 49 other states writ large, if not our Supreme Court?
Good question. I think that it is going on elsewhere, and I have now, partly through helping Jim Fetzer and Wolfgang Halbig, I have now some knowledge of stuff going on in Connecticut and Wisconsin, and it's the same deal. It is in Connecticut, the court there where Halbig and, you know, InfoWars and Alex Jones, they were all sued by these Sandy Hook plaintiffs. And that judge, Wolf wasn't even served. He had a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction because he's a Florida resident, and they sued him in Connecticut, and he doesn't conduct business in Connecticut. So his motion was pending for like 8 months, and also he was never served notice of stuff going on in the case. That judge just conducted ex parte proceedings, and she is also Catholic. And I think that, do I know how these people operate? Not really, but I do know, and Wikipedia even says that, like, the mafia and the National Crime Syndicate, which is the Jewish mafia, they cooperate. And I have seen this going on. And then in Wisconsin, the judge on Fetzer's case, the same deal. And when I talk about the fear, when I read the transcript of, like, the trial and the summary judgment hearing in that case, what you see is that the judge is repeatedly turning to Leonard Posner's attorney, who is Jake Zimmerman. That's a guy who grieved me. Repeatedly turning to him saying, is this how you would interpret it, Mr. Zimmerman? Is this what you would do? What do you think should be done here? It's like he was like a complete toady to Zimmerman. So he knew what side his bread was buttered on. It really is that clear. And the United States Supreme Court is the best example of all. 7 of the 9 justices are Catholics, and many of them are involved with Opus Dei. Remember the horrible scandal with Scalia. Scalia, you know, I mean, it certainly is speculative, but they didn't even do an autopsy. You'll remember that he's the one who came to his buddy in Texas's ranch in the Marfa area, and there's nothing over there. I mean, it's very remote, and I've heard some really sickening stories about what actually happened to him, but it had to do with child rape, let's just say that. And he was a member of Opus Dei. That was made public. And Clarence Thomas, I think that he is. His wife was very involved. And they don't, I think they don't have women members. It's more like women helpers. Thomas was another one. John Roberts, I can't remember if he is Opus Dei. I think, though, I've read that Alito may be. But anyway, Roberts, there was a weird report a few months ago that he was found with his head bloodied outside a gym, and that was never explained, and it never made the mainstream press. It's like, what the heck is going on? But yeah, I believe that they believe they can violate laws with impunity and that they are serving a higher master. As far as the rejection of that Texas complaint went, you know, I thought it was actually a brilliant idea by Ken Paxton, who is the attorney general here. I assume it was his idea. He brought it anyway. But I knew what the court would do with it because that's their standard thing. It's called standing to sue. And in federal court, you know, what you have is what they call a conservative court, but it's conservative in the sense of constitutional construction, meaning that they interpret their jurisdiction narrowly. So does Texas have standing to complain about how electors were, or rather, yeah, how electors were chosen or ballots were counted in other states? They said not. And so, you know, I mean, what we're seeing is that the Trump group has they've been regrouping and they're bringing that suit in different ways, but just not the state of Texas doing it. Because residents of those states can certainly complain. They certainly do have standing. And the Trump campaign itself does have standing. So they just, you know, have to regroup, as I said, and rebring it. And I don't actually know what's going on at the moment. But I was not surprised at all that they did that. I would have been very surprised if they did take the case. Because, you know, something like 99% of all cases taken to the U.S. Supreme Court, well, maybe it's 98%, get rejected. I mean, it's a really, really slim chance to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, thanks. And next we have Bonnie Faulkner. Bonnie, go ahead.
Yes, just very briefly, Sunny, and you already started to answer that when you were talking to Cheryl, but I'm assuming you became a target because of who you were defending. Who were you defending that made you a target?
Oh, it was primarily water. I represented real water users. Like I mentioned Animas La Plata, I represented you know, ultimately it was probably a couple thousand water users, although my group had a much smaller membership, but they were all harmed. And if we had been successful, it would have really benefited all these other water users in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico. Because what it was a bogus water project called Animas La Plata, which it was pushed on people as a proposed settlement of Ute claims to water. And what I showed with a heads up from my client who had lived in the area for a long time, I did all this research in the law library and found a string of cases that not only said that the Utes, those are the Indian tribes that were claiming all this water, but, you know, it wasn't really for the Utes, it was for Anglos who control the leaders of those tribes. I realize this is really a poor explanation, but at any rate, what I showed was that there was this huge settlement approved by Congress at the behest of these guys, like I mentioned, David Robbins, David Hayes, Greg Hobbs, these guys and water users handful of Anglo water users. They got acts of Congress and stuff by telling the Congress and funding by the American taxpayer. They told them that the Utes' claims for water have never been settled, and this will settle them. What I showed is that the Utes had no claims for water, and that's because, number one, their reservation was extinguished. It's a sad story, but it was extinguished in 1880, and they went back to court multiple times over the first half of the 20th century, and they were paid for their extinguished property interests. And they kept going back, and really they were paid two and three times, and that's actually what one dissenting court of claims judge finally said. His name was Skelton. His court awarded another multimillion dollar judgment to the Utes in the 1950s, and he said, I cannot go along with this because they've been paid multiple times, and they've also agreed that they've been paid for the same interests, and I'm not going to agree to this judgment. Well, then that went to the United States Supreme Court, and this opinion issued in 1971 that was authored by Justice Brennan, who was known as the most liberal, maybe the most liberal justice there has ever been, and I think it was an 8-1 decision against the Ute tribes, finding that they could not claim any more compensation and that they were done for a number of reasons. I mean, I can explain this better if I have more time. I'm trying to. At any rate, so that's what I brought up. As I said, there's this 1971 United States Supreme Court decision that says this project is illegal, that there is no claim of the Utes to settle. And the Utes themselves, like, they have a big timeline on their website, you know, all the things that have happened to the Utes, and they leave that decision out. They don't even mention it. And granted, bad stuff happened to them, but they were compensated for it. You know, it's what am I to say other than it's the American way to monetize injury. and in this case it was monetized many times over, and that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said, but they tried to bury that opinion. So I brought that out, and what my opponents were afraid of, I believe, is that I was going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and seek contempt. But I also had other really strong grounds. Like, I found that the original water right was granted, or it was applied for by an attorney for one of the applicants, the Southwestern Water Conservation District. This attorney made the application to the court for the water rights, and then he became the judge and granted them. That happened in 1966. So I found this stuff out, too. I mean, really huge, many, many things, many violations of law, lies to Congress. So they wanted to get rid of me. But that was only one case. There were other cases where, the mafia took over my client's subdivision in Summit County, and I was fighting that, too. And they just, so they made mincemeat out of me. And, you know, you talk, like John Olson says, come to Maine. Well, what I did move to Florida, and I wrote them a letter, and I said, I've had no due process. And they said, sorry, we won't let you in the bar. You have to go back to Colorado and get in good standing there before you can apply to Florida. So I've never tried again.
Okay.
And I'm, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Bonnie, for that question. And I also want to thank Kat and Bonnie for recommending Al Sunny to the call tonight. That's a great choice. So we have two more questions, Sunny. The next one is from Sheila Casey. Sheila, go ahead.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Sheila.
Sunny, whether you're familiar with the group called Make Americans Free Again.
Pam Popper.
Pam Popper. Are you familiar with her?
Yeah, I've watched many of her videos, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm just wondering what you think their chances are, because their entire mission is based on the idea that we do have, to some degree, a free judiciary. And it sounds like from everything you're saying that we do not. Do you have an opinion about whether they're going to be able to be successful?
No, I don't, and I'm ashamed to say I have not even finished reading the complaint that they filed. I mean, it's really long, which surprised me, because that's actually one of the things that courts will do, is kick out a long complaint, because Rule 8 says it should be a short and plain statement, you know, of, you know, what your beef is, of your right to relief. And it's over 100 pages, or maybe there are 100 exhibits or something. I am very interested in that, and I'm sorry not to be able to answer your question better. One thing I think, though, is that the judges still are sensitive to public opinion, even though they're not subject to anything. Nothing happens to federal judges, especially, and I think this is in federal court. You know, they're appointed for life. And what I see, and what others I'm in communication with see, is that there's actually no discipline of errant judges. It's really rare. But as far as a favorable decision goes, I mean, I certainly have my fingers crossed, and I think she's great, and I'm sure that the complaint is good, and I'm sorry to be uninformed about the nuts and bolts of it. But because there are so many people behind it, that's my understanding, it may have an impact. I mean, people who may even have power. In my case, what they saw was a sole practitioner. And even though I had many, many clients, I think they just saw me as, you know, a little hornet that they could step on. Or I like to say I was their little hemorrhoid. Actually, I learned that from... Anyway, they saw me as an annoying insect. Well, maybe more than that. They were afraid of me. I did run for Attorney General, and I actually beat Ken Salazar in La Plata County, which is where Animas La Plata is, where they're sucking all the water out for no reason whatsoever. And they're using the Indians as their, you know, as their cover. And the Indians not only have nothing to farm, they're not interested in farming. They've got actually great natural resources wealth already. And so they don't need the water. It's these Anglo water attorneys and farmers, a handful of farmers with hobby farms who have so much water now, it's enough to serve the city of Los Angeles. And maybe that's what they'll do with it. I don't know. Anyway, I'm sorry to get off on that, but yeah, I can't tell you, Sheila. I tell you what, though, I'll be on the next call, and I will be up to speed then if we get a chance to discuss it. And by the way, I really appreciated your. I listened to the last teleconference. I didn't participate in it, but listened to it, and I really appreciated your comments about the, I guess the Pentagon research. I personally don't want to go through that either. And I'm not even, I haven't even been with the battle the way you guys have, but I found your comments, and there was also a man who spoke at length. You were both very persuasive.
Well, thank you. Sure. Make Americans Free Again has actually filed a number of complaints now. The most recent one is against the CDC and Director Redfield, alleging that they've misled the American people about the coronavirus. So, saying their entire point is that there is no emergency because apparently thousands of lawsuits have been filed since this whole COVIDiocy started, and they've all been, almost all uniformly have been unsuccessful, with the complaint being that most of these lawsuits have alleged that somebody's constitutional rights have been abridged. And the answer always comes back, yes, but we can do this now because it's an emergency. Mm-hmm. And so what Pam Popper and her group are doing is instead challenging the very idea of there being an emergency. And that's why I think it seems to me like, not that I know much about law, but it sounds to me like a brilliant idea. And because I don't believe there is an emergency, so
no, I've
defies all
you.
These horrible lockdowns and all the terrible damage that's been done to all of us.
Okay. Thank
yeah,
you, Sheila.
I just listened to a really good interview with Catherine Austin Fitz, and yeah, I hope that you can find it. I don't know if I, remember the name of the interviewer, but it's a really good one. But yeah. I'm with you. It's a control mechanism, and it is an enslavement mechanism, this whole stupid thing, and there's no scientific basis for it at all. So I hope that they prevail on that. But you know what I can foresee is that the judge is going to say, well, it's discretionary with the executive whether or not it's an emergency. And the information available to the executive, the governor, and I think she's doing it against the governor of Ohio, right? She calls
him
emperor.
Yeah, they've also have one against now, the governor of New Mexico.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Can I ask you guys
sorry.
To cut that short? We have some other questions, and sorry.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Sheila. Okay, so we had one other person wanting to ask a question. Now we have three, so I'm going to cut it there, okay? So we'll get through the three, and if you could be brief, I'd appreciate that.
All right.
David Rolls, you're next. Go ahead. David? David Rold, are you there? Okay, maybe David.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Sonny. My name's David Rold. So I ran for the Green Party presidential nomination this year, and I spoke against the scamdemic at the Green Party National Convention. So I appreciate your work on this and, trying to sue Bill Gates for practicing medicine without a license. I'm wondering if you've talked with Cynthia McKinney in Georgia. She might know somebody in Georgia who could sign on with you. And then I co-founded the Greens Against COVID Repression with Ibrahim Taher, who ran as the Green Party candidate for Senate in Oregon. And but anyway, my main question for you is sort of similar to Sheila's question, but more general. Like, I know a lot of people who are filing lawsuits in various states and federal courts against all the lockdown repression, et cetera. And I'm wondering, is there any way that we can overturn, is there any chance that we can overturn this stuff with lawsuits, given that the whole judicial system is so corrupt, at least in the United States? I don't know if it's corrupt worldwide, but like, do you see like that being a strategy that's really going to work to end this tyranny?
Oh man, I wish I could give you some hope, but I really think that they are a very integral part of the deep state, and that's they're not going to do anything for us.
Yeah,
we must rise up and do something else, because I mean that is, unless, you know, if there's a way we can just like drive a wedge in somewhere and then open it up, and that actually, I mean, I have ideas about how to clean up the judiciary, obviously starting in Colorado because that's where I have my experience, but it's not easy. I mean, I mentioned that. I mentioned about the judges not even being elected there. But the elections are problematic anyway in Colorado. I also litigated election contests. So, I mean, what we have to do is figure out mechanisms by which citizens can be the regulatory authority of the courts. So it's like almost epicycles on epicycles. But the reason that the judges are in lockstep, they're afraid to get out of lockstep, and I believe it's because it is a really criminal enterprise, a criminal network. That's what I'm seeing. And you may have exceptions, like I mentioned Phil Brimmer, and I was amazed to see he's now the chief judge of the Colorado U.S. District Court. That's a good move. I mean, it's a really good move, and maybe it means that there are attorneys who also are being instrumental in influencing these things, good attorneys. But it's just that it's such a powerful thing. I mean, it's hard to figure out where to apply your efforts. It really is. But the answer is in citizen resistance. I think we all know that, and it's really hard to overcome the inertia. So
okay,
that's best.
All right. Thank you, David.
And,
okay. Oh, go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Did you? Okay. Okay. Next we have Judy Osterman. Judy, go ahead.
Okay. Hi. All right. Thank you for coming. All right. Something just came up tonight. I live in a hamlet, and I'm about 10 miles from Walmart and 5 miles from the other supermarket, and I don't have a car. So I just discovered that the short line bus, which is the only, it's not the only bus, it's the bus that serves this area, has stopped running because of the second, quote, the second wave of COVID, unquote. And since there's one other bus, which is a local bus. It only serves the immediate area, and the hours and the days are very limited. So I was wondering if Short Line can be sued since they are what amounts to a public transportation. And how would I go about that? Do you see?
Well, remember that you're asking someone for legal advice who's not supposed to give it, because I'm still under suspension. I haven't practiced since 2009. But again, you know, what you ought to do is get similarly situated people and make a big stink. It's really worrisome with this COVID garbage, because they are using that just to suppress people's liberties everywhere. So, I mean, I can't advise you other than talk to an attorney. I forgot what state you're in.
New York.
Did you say?
You're in New York.
You know, there are legal aid services. Usually they will do things like landlord-tenant matters. Maybe this sounds like something they ought to take up, because you can't get to where you need to get your groceries and stuff.
Right.
That's what you're saying, yeah.
I can't on weekends and after 4 in the afternoon.
that
I'm Well, call the legal aid place where you live. That's a start anyway. And then I don't know how you can link up with other people who are also injured by that, but they have to exist. Start handing out flyers or something. You must make a fuss. It's the only recourse. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
They're real.
Thank you. No.
Sure. I'm sorry I can't be of more help.
Okay. Right. And our last question is from David Brunette. David, go ahead.
Actually, this is Kathy Allard calling from Sonoma.
Uh-huh. Oh, are you on David's line? Is that why I'm getting that?
I'm not sure. I don't know, but the prompt came up for me.
Okay. Go ahead, then.
Yeah, I'm a psychologist, and I'm on the mental health kind of a group with Fran Shore and Marty Hopper and some others. I'm not very active on your teleconference, but I love it. I just wanted to say thank you for all you've done. You've been amazing, and you're a very eloquent and very smart woman. So,
thanks.
I'm very interested in if you have any feedback on what is going on in California. I've been following closely the lawsuits here in Los Angeles and San Diego, both of which had won initial verdicts to reopen, primarily through the testimony of Jay Bhattacharya, who is proving that the science is on our side against the lockdowns. The state presented no real viable scientific evidence, and I have his full document. It's fascinating in case anybody would like it, because I'm presenting it to our county Board of Supervisors, basically to substantiate their reference to any lack of science in California that's been established. It's wonderful. But both of those decisions got stayed by the appellate courts. So we're back again to square one. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on all that. The appellate courts, and to me, they seem to be much more corrupt than the local courts. But, you know, I don't know that we're going to see those decisions get their original ruling back, which is such a shame because it's the only hope we had here.
Oh, geez. Well, I assume. Pardon me?
I said the OGs didn't sound good.
You mean from me?
Yeah.
Well, actually, can you provide your opinion, your scientific expert opinion, to the lady who's got the bus problem? Because that's what she needs to do, too. And also take it to whoever the authority is that runs the buses, you know, the city or the county or some special district or something.
She needs to go to her county and figure out what her county people are doing, because there's all sorts of groups forming in every jurisdiction.
Good.
Questioning the lockdown. There's Facebook pages on reopen every city and every county. But I just was wondering if you had any information on the appellate courts, and you know, kind of what was going on that they just in general that the stay then was enacted and all the good verdicts were taken away.
Well, a stay is not. Generally, it's not a permanent thing. I mean, they have just sort of barred the injunction. I guess it's an injunction from taking effect until they can consider the case. And who knows how long it will be. But so the way they view it, at least I'm assuming this, and I don't know about these opinions, but the way they view it is that the governor, you know, again, another powerful figure, the most powerful figure of all, the governor is saying that there is an emergency. And so they want to make sure that, you know, if they are going against the governor, that they're on, you know, a firm basis. And that's, I guess, the best way I can put that. I'm really impressed to hear that the district court granted the injunction. Injunctions are hard to get. They're considered extraordinary relief. And I'm really, really impressed, and I'd like to read the opinions or whatever has issued in those cases too. But I, you know, without reading what they've issued, I can't really say other than stay just means, you know, you're back to square one, as you said, because there is no injunction now because the injunction has been stayed. So it stayed until there is a full briefing before the appellate court. That's what's going to happen now. So however long it takes to get those briefs in and get a decision, you're not protected. But you could actually even appeal to the California Supreme Court. You can appeal the stay ruling. I'm pretty sure you can do that because it's, you know, from your standpoint, it's an emergency. So
right.
I hope that your attorneys do that.
Right.
Sorry.
No, I just think it's just interesting. We're getting some leeway here, which is great.
But
the scientific evidence certainly is showing that we're winning in court. So if any of you
good.
Want our documents, you can email me at savesonoma2020.
What's your name again?
My name is Kathy.
Kathy.
Ballard. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You said Save Sonoma 2020. Yeah, I will send you an email because I'd like to read those too. Well, that's a wonderful development, and I really am pleased to hear that is there Save Sonoma 2020, and that's dot something.
So it would be, I think it'd be admin at Save Sonoma. It's also a website we just got going.
Okay,
and
great.
What we're doing here in California, for those who may not know, Kevin Kiley is really just a warrior attorney, Republican, who's challenging Newsom and suing Newsom. And he's developed what's called Healthy Communities Resolution, which is a resolution many counties in California have adopted to do things their own way and not follow the state's tyranny, in essence. Because every county has its own issues, has its own dilemmas, and so about 8 counties have adopted it.
Good.
And we're on a campaign right now to ask our members on our email campaign, of which we have about 1,000 right now in a 500,000 population county, but we're asking everybody to demand that our Board of Supervisors adopt this resolution. So there are things that, you know, you can begin doing on a local level against.
So, Kathy, Kathy, this is Cheryl, and I'm going to interrupt you only because of our time.
Of course.
Because it's really interesting. If people go to your website, this Save Sonoma 2020, can they get that information there?
They can email me right now. We're just starting the website. So, yeah, you can get a hold of me, and I'm happy to send you these documents. They're truly fascinating. But thank you.
Okay, so we can maybe put them in the minutes, too, a link to them or something so people can get them.
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and there are 2 other people who wanted to ask questions, but I cut off the questions before you had signed up, and unfortunately we're already going on 10 o'clock, so I'm going to cut it here. And don't be mad at me. Don't take it personally. It's just a time thing. We do have another speaker. and I want to really, really thank you, Sunny, for joining us tonight. It was very informative, and hopefully you'll join us again with some updates.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm supposedly a member,
great.
But I'm supposedly a member of this group, and I really, really am interested in wanting to get more involved in 9/11 stuff, although, you know, I've been sort of semi-involved for a number of years. Anyway, yes, thanks so much for your thank you.
Okay, sorry. Okay. All right, so thank you very much. Sorry, my 90-year-old mother was calling me as you were saying that. I apologize.
No problem.
So, yes, thank you very much. Okay, and you're welcome to stay on and hear our next speaker. I know you were very busy and have some deadlines coming up, but you're welcome to stay. Okay, great. All right, so we're going to go back into lecture mode here. Okay, and I'm just going to unmute our next speaker and Craig, because Craig is introducing him. There you are. Okay. Okay, so our next speaker is Paul Zaremka, and Craig is going to be introducing him. So, Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, Paul Zaremka, who I've known now for going on a decade now, ever since the Toronto hearings in 2011, I believe it was, earned his PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and was at the University of California, Berkeley, before joining State University of New York at Buffalo, where he is now professor of economics. His initial research and teaching were in the neoclassical economic theory and in econometrics, rethinking the basis of theory. And with almost 3 years at the International Labor Office in Geneva, Switzerland, he came to realize that a class-based approach to society, rather than an individualistic one, is required, concluding that Marx offered the foundation needing to be built upon. Since 1977, he has edited Research in Political Economy, a hardback annual. He's also published numerous articles and made many conference presentations in many countries, reaching a culmination with his new book, Key Elements of Social Theory Revolutionized by Marx. And he also was responsible for the very important and notable 9/11 book, The Hidden History of 9/11, which I enthusiastically recommend to anybody here if they want some great essays on 9/11 with some fantastic evidence in there. So anyway, that is that's what I'll say about Paul. And so I'm going to hand it over to you, Paul, and you can talk to us about the subject of your talk tonight.
Okay, thanks very much, Craig, for the introduction. So let me say a couple introductory remarks. So I've been a Marxist since more or less mid-1970s. And I'm an economist, so I came into Marxism more from the economic point of view than political point of view, but there was that political aspect that's always lurking in Marxist thought. And when 9/11 happened, I was not shocked like some people. I was not shocked. Rather, for me, it seemed like it could be something that the capitalist state wanted to engineer for its own purposes, but that's only a thought. That's just an hypothesis. And that led me basically to start to work on 9/11's research maybe around 4 months after it began. I heard Michael Rupert talk in Toronto. I think that really stimulated me even further. And then, like all of us, I mean, we just went through a lot of work, a lot of evidence. And that led me in around 2004, because I was in communicating with a lot of other people. I also edit something called Research in Political Economy, which is an annual hardback. I mean, it's an expensive academic publication, but I was confident that I had the no problems with my academic freedom, that if I got people saying whatever they wanted about 9/11, that the publisher would not stop me. And so I invited, I offered my publication as an outlet for what became The Hidden History of 9/11. And that was published in 2006. And one thing that's interesting about that, when I was putting together who the authors would be, I did not pass any judgment about the politics of the people, whether they were right or left or upside down or whatever. Okay, it wasn't an issue. It wasn't Marxist either. Okay, it turns out that every single person in that book, I think it's correct, every single person on that book is left of center. But that wasn't by choice. I mean, that wasn't because I censored anybody. It was just how it worked out, if you want to put it that way. And maybe two or three of them are also Marxist, but that's not really that important, but I just want to mention that. Now, some of you may know Seven Stories Press, which is in New York City, and they do a lot of important work and independent publication. And I offered to do a paperback edition of that book, and that came out in 2008. Now, that's much more expensive. I mean, that's like $15. That's the one Craig is probably talking about, because the other one's like $150. But why did I get interested in 9/11? It was because, as a Marxist, I was interested in the politics of the state, which I myself hadn't studied enough before, because I'd focus more on economic questions. Now let me just skip all the way up to last month when we had this teleconference. And the woman who spoke last time, I had no respect for, and I said it openly to her. And I just said, basically, I couldn't believe the fact that she would think that FDR was involved in selling the United States to China. And at a certain point, I said, she was making comments about how Donald Trump was for the American people, and I thought that that was ridiculous, that the only person I know among the candidates who were running for president it would be Bernie Sanders, who I really, and I still think, is the only one who really talks from the point of view of ordinary people, not high up. And is concerned about the life of particularly the poorest people in the country and the people who don't have any jobs and the people who don't have any health and coverage, health insurance and coverage and so forth. Anyway, that's my opinion about Sanders. And I mentioned that to I think it's Susan was her name, and she just simply said, he's a communist, as if that's the end of the discussion. And, well, I guess it was at that point that I decided maybe I'd mention to Craig that I'd be willing to make a presentation tonight. When I was thinking about doing it, I was thinking about actually making a kind of a 20-minute. I'm a professor. Professors have time limits, so if I'm supposed to talk 20 minutes, I talk 20 minutes or maybe 22 minutes, but not 45 minutes or not an hour and a half, okay? So I was thinking of how could I do a presentation on Marx in 20 minutes? And, well, first of all, it's getting late. And secondly, I think there's a better way to go about this. Let me mention just a couple of things. When people say that somebody's a communist, as if that's terrible, let me just ask, first of all, just a simple question. Why do you think that a religious figure like Jesus is not a communist? I mean, why is he not a communist? I mean, love thy neighbor seems to be kind of a communist idea. So what's so bad about being a communist? There was a movie... I'm trying to think of the name of the movie, Rosie the Riveter, after 1945, after World War II, where they were giving interviews of people, of women who had lived through the production process in World War II, and there was this woman working on a battleship, and there was a Filipino worker in this movie. I mean, she's describing in the movie a Filipino worker who was being shit on by other workers for being Filipino, and there was total discrimination. And she was so angry that she took her blowtorch and threatened to torch the guy if he didn't stop. The guy started crying and apologizing and so forth and so on. But what was interesting is at the end of that, she said in this movie, if you want to call me a communist because of what I did, then I'm the biggest communist there ever was. What I'm trying to get at is let's get past the words and talk reality and don't just dump on people who say communist, people who say Marxist or whatever. I'll stand up right now and say I'm a Marxist and you can do whatever you want with me, but let's have a rational conversation about it. So that's one of the things I wanted to say. Another thing I wanted to say is that there are some famous people who you may or may not know or are at least supportive of Marx, if you don't want to call them a Marxist. First of all, one of the most important Marxist publications in the United States since 1948 is something called the Monthly Review, and the lead article in that first publication is nobody other than Albert Einstein. Secondly, if you look at a little history about Helen Keller was so left-wing that she wasn't even interested in the women's right to vote because she thought that wouldn't do anything. I'm not saying I agree with her about that, but I'm just describing Jack London as another one who's a Marxist. So there are, I mean, if you want to dump on people because they're Marxists, then you have to dump on all these three people also. Next thing I want to say just is an introduction to myself and my own Marxism. I've never supported the Soviet Union. So if you're going to try and say, well, Stalin did this and so forth and so on, that isn't the kind of Marxism I'm interested in. I'm interested in what Marx himself wrote and what he was promoting. I'm not even so much interested in subsequent Marxists. I am interested in subsequent Marxists, but often from the point of view of how they distorted Marxism, not how they sustained Marxism. The one important exception I would make to that would be Rosa Luxemburg, who was the first woman who got a PhD in economics and also led the Polish Social Democratic Party. As you may or may not know, she was born in Poland, but under Russian occupation at the time. Then she moved to Germany and became very important, but was murdered right after the First World War, so she never really had the full impact that she otherwise would have had. So what I think is the best thing to do is, rather than me give you a lecture, even 10 minutes on Marxism, is I think I'd like to just open it up to questions. And if I can't answer, or if I think it's too big a question to do in a short time, I'll just say so. How's that? Is that okay, Craig?
Yeah, so let me just put it into Q&A then, if that's what you'd like to do. Okay, so if anyone would like to ask Paul a question, please go ahead, star 6. Okay, so Paul, we have a couple here that are started. Let's go with one. First one right now is from David Rolls. David, go ahead. David? Are you with us, David?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Paul. So I'm a Marxist and a communist too, and I'm working against this like fascist tyranny that we're under, where the World Economic Forum has taken over the UN and the World Health Organization, and hit us with a fake hoax pandemic that they're using as a public health pretext to institute like global totalitarian technocratic fascism on us. And there are no leftist organizations who are organized against this. So I find myself having to work with a lot of right-wing people, and I cringe every time they call it communist. But I mean, what can I do when there aren't any leftist organizations like standing against this? I think I'm actually a Stalinist. I supported the Soviet Union, and I thought I supported China until last year, and I'm wondering about China now. Like, why are they pretending? Why are they going along with this hoax and like pretended there was a virus and made phony videos and but anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that it's like we have to work with right-wing people who think of this stuff as communist, who think of fascism and communism as the same, and it's like it's hard to argue with them when we don't have any leftist organizations that are opposing this tyranny. So I don't know if you have a response to that.
Oh, wait, let me just unmute Paul. Okay, Paul,
yeah,
you're
no,
on mute.
I don't agree about Stalin, but I'm going to pass over that. When I cited people on 9/11, I didn't care about their politics. I mean, I cited some people who would be considered anti-Semitic, in the worst way or whatever you want to call it. But if they were getting at the truth, it's in the book. I mean, it's in my work on 9/11. But
well, find anything truthful in what Susan said last month? Like, I didn't agree with her stuff about FDR and China, but she explained very clearly like what the goal of these people who have perpetrated this pandemic is, to like enslave us with the technology and the vaccine passports and everything. So, didn't you find
that? Okay, look, let me just say this about the pandemic, and that is I do research. When I want to get to a point, I do it seriously. I haven't studied it simply that deeply. I am in the process now of trying to understand it better. But right now, I do not want to take a position that this is a, that this is my gut feeling is that this is real. That these people that a quarter of a million. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's not real. The same number of people are dying as every year. They just like when somebody dies.
Oh, there's excess deaths of about quarter of a million people. Excess death. About a quarter of a million
there's
people in the United
There's some excess death of people dying from the lockdown measures, but there isn't much excess death. And there, whenever somebody dies, they say you have COVID, they count it as COVID. And they're not even counting flu numbers this year. They're counting every case of the flu as COVID.
Now, wait a minute. Let me say how you do excess deaths and see where you disagree with me. As I understand excess deaths, you look at the deaths by month throughout the full year, this full year, and you compare it to what it was last year. If you did it really corrected, you'd have to correct for population size.
Right.
You'd have to correct some age distribution changes. But that would be, relatively speaking, small. And you look at, see, the total number of deaths this year were the second to last day of the year compared to the entire amount last year. And don't pay any attention to whether it's COVID or flu or heart attack
or
murder. And you get, wait a second, and you get about a quarter of a million people more dead this year than last year. That's excess death. It's got nothing to do with counting about COVID.
That's not accounting for the population increase. You didn't account
for the population increase is nowhere near that. It's nowhere near, I mean, the population increase is about 2 or 3%. It's not, we're talking about numbers in the order of 50% more.
No, you have to count 100,000 for every year because when they're doing the 250,000, that's over the average of the deaths of the past 5 years. So you have to go back 3 years and, like, account for the population increase for the past 3 years. But this isn't that important. Even if there is an excess death of 150,000, well, first of all, some of it could be from the lockdown measures. It doesn't all have to be from COVID. But it doesn't matter. Even if COVID exists, you don't shut down the whole world and, like, cause misery to the whole world and plunge the whole world into depression and tyranny, like, to try to stop a respiratory disease when we deal with these things every year. That's, like, not the way you do it. This whole thing was planned by Bill Gates and the World Economic Forum, and we know that. The World Economic Forum took over the United Nations last year. There were petitions complaining about it, and Bill Gates is the largest contributor to the World Health Organization through his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and his Gavi Vaccine Alliance, and he directed them to falsely declare this a pandemic so that he can like push these vaccines and, you know, it possibly like make hundreds of billions of dollars with the vaccines or possibly kill a lot of people because he's a eugenicist, and you should look into that.
Okay, well, as I say, I've done very little research compared to what I'd like to do to have an answer to this. I've just
just because Susan was like wrong about this stuff with FDR and China, like, doesn't mean that there's like not a problem with like us being tyrannized by people using a fake pandemic.
So, Aaron, David, are you all set?
I suppose so.
Okay. All right. Next question is from Sheila Casey. Sheila, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Paul. I have a more kind of abstract, high-level question for you, or maybe I'll preface this with my own statement. I once considered myself a leftist. And for quite a while, I really believed that the left was going to be the answer. And I worked hard to get Democratic candidates elected and to try to shift the balance of power away from the Republicans really believing that this would bring an end to many of the illegalities that were going on in the middle of the last decade, you know, illegal wiretapping and our illegal wars and those tortures at Guantanamo Bay. This was before I knew about 9/11, but since finding out, since having my, say, political awakening and finding out about what's really going on, which includes 9/11 and many other false flag operations and the operations of the deep state, I've really shifted dramatically to the right because I see, and it's hard for me to understand how someone can continue to be a leftist knowing all of the evil that has been perpetrated by government. Now, much of it is done, I agree, in concert with corporations and with billionaires such as, say, Bill Gates. But I'm more sympathetic to the point of view of wanting government to be small enough to drown it in a bathtub, because I don't like government power and I don't like what I see government power doing, and I don't see much good that comes out of it. And what they're currently doing in showering benefits of all kinds over the entire populace to me seems just like they're trying to placate us as they destroy the economy and lure us into a situation where we're going to require a universal basic income to survive. And that sounds like what a communist would like, but would create a situation of very little power for all of us, and we would be then perhaps in a situation where they could say, you don't get the vaccine, we're going to shut off your universal basic income, or you don't get the chip, you're not going to get your universal basic income payment this month. And it's just hard for me to understand how people can continue to be leftists once they realize things about 9/11 and all of the other false flag operations that have taken place that you and I are both, and many people on this call, are well aware of. So I was just wondering if you could address that.
Oh, that's a big question. Basically, I have to object to the basic premise, which is you think that communism or Marxism means a big state. But in fact, it really should mean, I'm not saying what it does mean, but what it should mean is a process of getting rid of the state and having workers and ordinary people controlling their own lives in love with other people. That's what it should mean. That's what communism should mean. But getting from here to there is an enormously complicated political question, and there's been huge mistakes made along the way. But to give you one example is exactly what happened in Chile on the same September 11th, but in 1973, where we had an extremely right-wing government, extremely right-wing coup by Pinochet against a leftist government. So I don't think Trump is a Pinochet, but Trump could be leading us to a Pinochet in next decade, let's say. I don't know what else to say. It's such a big question to ask.
Yeah, but I realize that was a very high level question, and I'll just say that I've never heard of any kind of leftism that involves a small government. It seems to me that every kind of leftist point of view that I've heard of means more government control, more funds basically getting funneled through government before they get to the people, you know, whether it could be health care or various other kind of benefits. And it certainly seems to me like we're going in that direction now.
That's kind of so-called liberalism, left liberalism. And yeah, and sliding over into a certain kind of social democracy. Well, I don't want to say social democracy. I don't know what it means. That's another complicated topic. Bernie Sanders considers himself as. Forget it for the moment about what Sanders considers himself. I mean, I really do think Sanders really does care, and he talks about it all the time, of how people at the poorest level of society are suffering. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing for a presidential candidate to be doing.
Okay.
By the way, another presidential candidate that I respected was Ralph Nader. Not that I agree with everything, but just I felt Ralph Nader's an honest guy. So I supported him. I didn't support the Republicans or the Democrats when they were running. I supported Nader.
Yeah, I voted for Nader as well when he was running for president.
Good.
Okay, well, I guess we can just leave it there. If you have any links or any references that you could provide about this type of leftism you're talking about that involves a small government, I'd be interested in seeing them.
I can mention one. The group in Mexico in Chiapas, Mexico, which is a Native American based movement. Somebody help me. I can't remember the name right now. But anyway, they are definitely a small oriented group. I mean, not they are definitely anti-government, if you want to put it that way.
Okay.
But I'm anti-capitalist. I'm anti-capitalism. I'm anti-capitalist. Okay. So I think the government follows the capitalist, and therefore I'm not. If you're against the government, I would say, but you haven't really confronted the capitalist like Donald Trump. For example, I mean, a clear example of a capitalist, if there ever was one. I can't understand how anybody can support Donald Trump. The guy's a fucking liar. It's bottom line. I'm not saying that other people aren't also, but he is for sure.
Well, I will say that I think what we have going on now seems to be a combination of a kind of super capitalism with communism, and that's because I don't believe the people who are really controlling us at this point and running the world have any ideology at all other than their own self-enrichment, and they will say whatever seems the most expedient to them at the moment. And one reason we're in such a terrible situation is because of the fact that, and this could be super capitalism, because of the fact that Bill Gates has has assets of something like $100 billion. And with that amount of money, he's able to control so many things, including with donations to universities and donations to the media. He's able to control the public perception of himself and the public perception of the experimental injections they want to give us, that it makes it very difficult for the rest of us to have.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
So I see a great evil coming from that, a great evil coming from people who acquire such vast sums that they then can, you know, like kind of create their own gravity that the world bends around them. So I see that as a great evil as well. But I know we're running out of time, and maybe we should just leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Sheila.
Yeah, and Paul, if you could provide us a link to that Mexican group you mentioned, we could put that in the minutes. So,
okay.
Our next question is from John Olson. John, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, good. The Zapatistas is what he's talking about in Chiapas in Mexico.
That's right.
Zapatista organization. Now, I want to talk to the lady that was just saying she was conflating leftist and communism with this Democratic Party and the imperialists. So that's a fundamental error. Anybody who's a leftist and worth their salt is anti-imperialist. They want to dismantle this monstrosity that's crushing us all over the world. That's what leftism is. And to make a new society, the new evolving ideology is eco-socialism, because we've got to take care of the resources of Earth, because if we don't, we're done. So that's a very critical point here. That's just in its infancy, and we don't want this big overhead, you know, tyrannical government. That's definitely not on our agenda. So it's we're the people who are fighting against that, and of course there's some people on the right. So we need to have some conversations with rational people on the right that are not the Trumpers, by the people who have legitimate critiques, as we do, of the society. I had a couple years ago a great meeting with some folks from the Libertarians, a few of us Greens and a few of us Libertarians, and within 2 hours we had 10 points of agreement. So that's what we need to be doing, rather than getting tied up with false consciousness about what Marxism is or what communism is. And, because I'm from the left, too, from the 60s. I mean, I consider myself an unrepentant 60s radical activist and have been ever since. So that's what I wanted to say. I probably could have some other things, but I'll let somebody else take it from there. Just don't conflate the Democratic Party and their defense of imperialism and engagement, especially aggression against Russia and China, as being any way left. It ain't.
Right. I agree 100%.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, John. And our last question comes from Fern Tishman. Fern, go ahead.
I've been, taking notes. So thank you for your talk. I was totally unaware of everything in my family, and I came into Ralph Nader, the Green Party, in 1996. And he was involved with Clinton impeachment proceedings, and one of the issues that was the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, Oklahoma Federal Building, and also Bill Gates and monopolies. That was part of Clinton impeachment proceedings, but Clinton deregulated media. And today, tonight, Economic Update had a thing on describing socialism and different aspects of it. And he agreed with you, Paul, that it's about each person having a voice and a part in our government. Also, I was listening tonight to Glenn Greenwald, and he was talking about every single one of the people that the new, president, whatever, is Biden, that they're all Facebook authority figures. So we're going to have a problem with media. So I need help with that. And I wanted to say about 9/11 and the Catholic, the Catholic Church. When 9/11 began, Les Jameson began our 9/11 Truth Group, and I would go to Ground Zero, and I would talk to, Controlled Demolitions was there, and I would talk to the workers, and I would talk to the people building, and they would just tell me, well, the Bible says, everything's going to fall apart, so, at the end of it, it doesn't really matter, we can do whatever we want. So they use the Bible to earn money. So what else did I write down here? I really appreciate you talking about 9/11, because that's why I'm in this thing right now. I would love your email so I could, hear more about what you have to say. And I, this is a learning process for me, but I write absolutely every day about 9/11 and how coronavirus began, and it was started in 2016 and 2017, and everybody knew about it in January, and they didn't do anything till March, and it just keeps getting worse, and no plans to stop it, absolutely no plans to stop the economic crisis. So the economic crisis, it would be better to get rid of the money going to the Pentagon and for wars. The people might get $2,000, but take all that, both billions of dollars we're giving the Pentagon. So I don't know how to put it all in the question, but I wanted to get my voice out because I write every day. It's better to talk. So thank you for letting me share. You can take it from there. Thank you for letting me share.
Yeah, okay. Let me just make a couple of things about, first of all, about the military budget. Our military budget of $750 billion is I guess, equal to the top, to the, excuse me, the next 10 in the world added together. I mean, it's totally absurd. We could drop it down to $50 billion or $100 billion, and we would be much better off. But anyway, I just want to make a comment about that. You ask about my email. It's very simple. You know my how to spell my last name because it's in the agenda. So just it's Remke at Buffalo. That's my city, buffalo.edu, education. So Buffalo, it's Remke at buffalo.edu. And in terms of the book, it's also mentioned on the agenda, The Hidden History of 9/11, Are Key Elements of Social Theory Revolutionized by Marx? Both of those, I mean, you can just do a real quick web search. The first one, the 9/11 book, is published by Seven Stories Press, and it's only about $15 or $17, something like that. The other book is, unfortunately, right now, in the initial year, at $150 by Brill Press, but some of you may know about Haymarket Books, and they will be publishing the book 1 year from now, and it'll be much cheaper. I don't know what level it'll be, but it'll be much cheaper 1 year from now than it is now. The other thing I want to say about my book, Key Elements of Social Theory Revolutionized by Marx, is that I try to cut to the core of what Marx was trying to get at, while at the same time showing you limitations are problems with Marx, and basically coming to one conclusion that Marxism is a drop in the bucket, but a kind of a golden drop in the bucket to how to understand society. That's my basic point, that we have a lot to learn about how societies run, but I can't see a better way to start with it than within the Marxist framework of Marx himself, not what other people say is Marx. Okay, that's all I want to say. Thanks for your comment.
Okay, thank you, Fern. Okay, and we have one last question, Paul, and it is from Judy Osterman. Judy, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, okay. All right, thanks for coming. And I consider myself an anti-capitalist and anti-elitist, and I admire the goals of communism, but I don't know enough about communism or socialism to give myself a label. So anyway, but I'm interested, you said that you were studying, that you weren't surprised that 9/11 happened and that you were studying it, and I was wondering what you learned about false flags in general and about the goals of the capitalist state in perpetrating 9/11. And also, I'd like to say that I consider the COVID thing another false flag. And I agree with David and John. We're both in the same Greens Against COVID Repression group. And I would recommend that you attend one of our meetings or get in touch with us by email, because we can give you a lot of links with which to further study the evidence that we have about COVID being a false flag and the goals that the perpetrators have. Okay.
Yeah, I'd be happy to attend. So yeah, just send me, you know, somebody send me by that email I gave, just when and where it is, and I'll join. In terms of, I mean, you ask a lot of other questions about conspiracies. So one of the things I did in the book is I didn't do anything about 9/11, I mean, it's about the pandemic, but I looked at the history of other conspiracies. For example, the sinking of the Maine in Havana Harbor, leading to our participation in the Cuban-American War, or Mexican-American War, I guess you'd say it. So I examined that. I looked at the beginnings of World War One and the killing of the Archduke. I looked at Gliwice, which was the beginning of World War II in Europe, not the beginning of World War II in Asia. I looked at the beginning of World War II in Asia, which is the Japanese, it was hardly a false flag. It was such a ridiculous thing that started the Japanese invasion of Manchuria that really didn't even qualify as a false flag. It was kind of ridiculous because the Japanese simply bombed a train track, and nobody was hurt. The trains, after the rail was corrected shortly thereafter, they could even have trains run over, and yet they claimed that the Chinese had done it, and they started a war against Manchuria as a basis of the Asia, of the Japanese interventions in Asia starting in World War II. I also looked at the Reichstag. I looked at particularly carefully at the John F. Kennedy assassination. By the way, I want to make some comment about that, and maybe somebody can help me with this. I had always thought that the concept of the deep state came from Peter Dale Scott. I mean, that's where I was first introduced to the deep state. And I know him pretty well, actually. And I never considered him to use the deep state in the same way that Trump is being using it now. His perception is completely different, as far as I can understand. But if I'm wrong, and there is some other use of deep state that has nothing to do with Peter Dale Scott that came before that, I'd like to know about it. Anyway, so I looked at that. I also at the Martin Luther King assassination, which of course had a trial in 1999 that nobody covers. In fact, so many people I know don't even know that there was a trial that convicted the government for the assassination of Martin Luther King. I looked at 9/11 and also Pearl Harbor, and the major conclusion I came, and that's the last chapter of my book, is that they are all so disparate. I mean, you can't just lump them all together. They're quite different kinds of episodes. But at the same time, I tried to look at each one of them objectively to see if it really was true what was asserted. Was it really the case that the Reichstag fire was done by the Nazis? I concluded that it was, but I looked at it carefully. I looked at the opposite point of view, and the same thing was true with Gliwice, which is even in William Scheer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I mean, he was sure it was set up by the Nazis, and it is, okay? But you have to look at the evidence. You have to think carefully about the evidence. It's kind of interesting because when it first happened, the New York Times reported it, and they reported it like it was kind of nothing very special. They certainly didn't think it was a Nazi-planned event. They just certainly did not say that. And you weren't reading that in the newspapers at that time. It only in one newspaper in Australia did somebody know that the Nazis had done it, because he knew the Gliwice very, very well and knew that there's no way that the Polish soldiers would have crossed the border and gone several miles into the border near army barracks to do what was claimed that was done. But that was because somebody knew what they were talking about. Okay. I'm not sure I covered every. Is there something else you wanted to ask me?
How do you think all these various disparate false flag events or conspiracies have advanced the capitalist state as opposed to the working class?
I guess I would. That's a hard question. I guess it's a form of extreme oppression, but I don't know if I'd really want to say that it's directly connected to the rising of the working class, because I don't see that that's really the case. It's not really the case around 9/11, unless one thinks of it as some kind of decline of the American empire worldwide, which drove the necessity for 9/11, which I think that's a credible argument, but it's not quite a working class argument of repressing the working class per se. So it's a tough question.
Okay.
We're not the same. We are. Yeah. I mean, in the 1930s, even in the United States, we had a fascist coup attempt in the United States, which actually failed, but it was attempted. I mean, there was a march on Washington, and I don't remember, it was 1933 or 34, which, unfortunately, the soldier I can't remember his name right now, who was supposed to lead it, actually, the beans.
Right.
Smedley Butler?
Yep.
Butler.
Yep, exactly, Butler.
Okay, you all set, Judy?
Yeah, I just want to make one final comment. When you talk about the enormous amount of money and material that the United States has devoted to the military, I think that the reason for that is because the United States, in the economic theory of comparative advantage, that the United States is the military arm of worldwide capitalism. Or not worldwide, but Western capitalism, and including Europe, Australia, and so forth. They have things that we don't have, like socialized medicine. They can spend their money on that because they don't spend it on the military. Okay, that's all.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
I understand your point.
Okay, thank you, Judy. And we have one last question, Paul, and this is the last question. So if anyone else, we're going to end it here. This Ann Hendricks, you're up. Go ahead, Ann.
Hey, Paul, this is Ann.
Hi, Ann.
A quick note. I wish you had been able to provide like 10 or 12 points to about what Marxism means to you, of course, because as I have seen either Marxism or communism in the world, it certainly is not attractive at all. The people seem totally or quite oppressed. Anyway, I just wanted to say that in the Bible, God says that he likes small government too. He was talking to Samuel, and I'm just going to give you a reference, that's all. It's 1 Samuel 8:7, and he's talking to Samuel, who's like a judge. And he said, they haven't rejected you, they rejected me. So because the people wanted a king, just like the other nations. And God was telling Samuel, hey, he's going to press your children into service, and he's going to, tax you and take your fields and your vineyards and all that. Anyway, I'm just giving you a reference. That is 1 Samuel 8. That was his opinion. He didn't want big government either. But it would have been good to hear some specific points that we could draw from as far as how your description of Marxism is. Thank you. That's all.
Yeah. Let me. I need to make one comment about. Which some people won't agree with, at least on this call, and that is, a major point in my book is that there was a distortion by Engels of some of Marx's work. And the distortion by Engels led to a political reasons, another distortion by the leading Russian Marxist, I'm not talking about Lenin, the guy named Plekhanov, who was considered sort of the leading Marxist in Russia, who was connected to Engels, not Marx. And he, in turn, influenced Lenin. And that led to a whole cult of what Marxism was thought to represent for more or less a whole century. And if you and the part of Marxism that I am affiliated to is a Marxism which is trying to re-understand that whole history. It's a history that's not very nice in a lot of ways. And therefore, I'm not going to try and dissuade you from your comment about governments that have been considered Marxist. But I will make one exception about that. And that is, I think Fidel Castro in Cuba, I mean, yes, there are things you won't like about Cuba, I suppose. But I think that guy's a pretty brilliant guy. A pretty damn brilliant leader. And if compared to slave owner George Washington, I mean, he's way ahead. And even today, Cubans are sending doctors in other countries helping their medical problems in ways that the United States is only trying to undercut. So I'm not trying, I hope you don't read me as being pro-Cuban per se. I don't know exactly what that would mean, but I'm just trying to say compared to what our government does, I think I'd go for the Cuban government even, or especially under Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ann, are you all set?
Yeah. I'm fine.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, Paul. So that's the end of our questions, and thank you so much. We asked people on the last call to either recommend other people or volunteer themselves. Paul, you volunteered, and we really appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you for
your
presentation. And also thanks to Kat and Bonnie for recruiting Sunny. Great presentations tonight, so thank you. So that takes us into the next phase of our call, which is announcements or any other topics that people want some quick discussion on, anything? And
Craig?
Craig, go ahead. I'm going to take people on Q&A mode just while you're doing that.
I have two quick things. One is just to tell people probably what many of you already know, which is that the AE 9/11 Truth documentary 7 has come out. It is now you can purchase it, and at some point it may be hopefully it will be available to watch for free on streaming services, perhaps even Netflix. So fingers are all crossed about that. But it can be purchased. And also just beyond that, the more we kind of share the fact with other people, then perhaps the more interest we can get in the film, and it's quite a professionally made film, so it's something that could be of interest to people outside the movement, which is really what we need so badly to do. So that's one thing. And so it's ae911truth.org where you would get more information about it. The second thing I want to mention is kind of a slight update on the confrontation following my presentation last call. I thought I would just point this out, that the comment was made, first of all, the general comment was made by Fran Schur that everybody, that not everybody, but that our group is a belief group, not an evidence group. and that, you know, the group that she's part of is talks on the level of evidence, not on the level of belief. Well, I found the ironic thing about this, and I will sum up my thoughts in writing at some point and post them on my blog, but what struck me was, in fact, her lack of knowledge of her own group indicated that her enthusiasm for her fellow group members actually is entirely based on belief and not based on evidence at all. But I thought one particular comment I wanted to mention, that she'd said that David Chandler had once referred to CIT as scum, and he now will say he just wishes he hadn't used that word, but the sentiment, he maintains the sentiment to this day. But since our call, I got into a bit of a discussion with him on Facebook, and just to update people, he is prepared to call CIT's research worthless, and he calls it their involvement with Lloyd England deeply offensive and cruelly exploitative. So I would just say that he's just as interested in staying away from evidence there as anything that anyone else would accuse me or other members of this group of. So anyway, I just give you that little update. That's it for me.
Okay, thanks, Craig. Anyone else have any updates or comments? Okay, so next month we have one presentation already lined up for on the moon landing. And so anyone else want to recommend someone or volunteer themselves, please either contact Craig or myself, and we'd really appreciate that. And I also wanted to just bring up briefly that some people have suggested to me that we only do one speaker per call and rather than two, and I just wondered if anyone had any thoughts about that, if that would appeal to them, to keep it shorter. Anyone have a thought on that? No. Okay.
Yeah, I have a thought.
Yeah,
my thought is, frankly, more discipline needs to be in place here. I mean, if people are going to be given 20 minutes, well, okay, give them 30. But at that point, I mean, somebody should interrupt and say, okay, time for Q&A to come up. And then we can have two people more comfortably. But both last time and this time, I thought, I'm not talking about myself now, but I thought that it went on too long sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I understand what you're saying, Paul. My thinking is that, you know, when we have somebody who's very knowledgeable and people are into it and the Q&A goes on long, I hate to cut that off. That's what we're here for, right, is to discuss and learn. And so, but I understand what you're saying. Yeah, so, okay, I appreciate your comment. Anyone else?
Craig?
Yeah, Craig?
Yeah, I'm glad Paul mentioned that because I had thought about making some kind of comment about this at the beginning. I put myself in a bad position last month, and I apologize for that because I put myself in the position of giving a presentation and not being able to hand off the moderating duties to someone else. And so what ended up happening was that I felt really awkward about cutting anybody off because I thought it would seem very self-serving, particularly if it was some negative comments. So as a result, yeah, there were a couple that went on way too long, and then other people figured, okay, well, that's the standard, so we'll go long too. I will say this one thing though is I learned a lot from that. It ended up being beneficial in ways that I will explain at some point. But definitely I'm a believer in discipline as well. And I just put myself in a position where I felt inhibited about cutting people off because I thought it would seem self-serving. So anyway, I think Paul's right though. I think it's something we should, within reason. I mean, we've got to find a happy medium, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Okay, thank you, Craig. Anyone else? Okay, so I guess that's the end of that discussion for now then. And all right, so I guess we're at the end of our program tonight. So thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we'll see you next month. And again, if you have any suggestions for speakers, please let us know. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And Craig? Oh, Craig's off.